edition of the BBC Music Magazine podcast is sponsored by Adagio, the leading streaming service for classical music. Discover Adagio's tailor-made search, expert playlists, and exclusive recordings for yourself. Visit podcast.adagio.com and enjoy 14 days for free.
So welcome to the BBC Music Magazine podcast. I'm the magazine's editor, Oliver Condy. And before we get started, a reminder that the November issue is out now, which brings me to our special discount for podcast listeners. You can all now get 30% off every six issues, which takes the cost to just £25.15. And you can claim the offer by visiting buysubscriptions.com/musicpodcast. Don't forget our website at classical-music.com, where you can read about all the latest music happenings, see thousands of reviews, enjoy our free download of the week, and a good deal more. Plus, we're on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and we have an iPad edition available on the App Store. And finally, do sign up to our newsletter via the website.
The BBC Music Magazine Podcast.
And with me in the studio today are managing editor Rebecca Franks and reviews editor Michael Beek.
Hello.
Hello.
So indeed, it's time for music news. Rebecca, tell us what's been happening.
One of the stories that caught my eye recently was that the London Symphony Orchestra and Sir Simon Rattle have announced they're going to open an East London Music Academy for young musicians from diverse and disadvantaged backgrounds who show exceptional promise. Rattle described why they're doing this, and for him a key question is, why do our groups of classical musicians not look like London looks, and what can we do about it? And they decided to take this proactive step to set up an academy for 11 to 18-year-olds involving 10 London boroughs, including two of London's poorest boroughs, Tower Hamlets and Hackney, and two of the least poor, Bexley and Havering, to really give musicians, young musicians, an opportunity to develop and work with some of the best musicians in the country. And I think with potentially kind of opening up a kind of pathway for them to potentially feed into the London Symphony Orchestra in later years.
It's quite a potent mix, isn't it, Rattle in the LSO? Because the LSO has always had a great track record of sort of going out to communities ever since, particularly actually, it moved into LSO St Luke's and had the ability to stage all that kind of activity. But Simon Rattle's sort of one of his, I think, big things about coming back to London was to get involved with this kind of project.
Yes, he's one of those conductors who really... he doesn't just stand up in front of the orchestra and do the conducting bit. That, I mean, obviously he has to do that. Quite a key part of the job. But as you say, he's really seems to be championing being involved with the communities that the orchestra immediately serves.
Definitely. And it's a long game as well, isn't it? It's not just sort of an immediate sort of result that they're looking for. This is looking far into the future to sort of change the sort of the makeup of the orchestra in the years to come.
Yes.
And East London, it's great to see East London. You know, obviously we had the Olympics, so there was a lot of East London was redeveloped. And then we had also the BBC's new space is being built in East London. And then this project, it's nice to see sort of things travelling a little bit east. I mean, I know London's only one city, but still it's a big city, and
it's a flagship orchestra as well, isn't it, in a way, for the city. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are lots of orchestras there. I'm not trying to suggest that the others aren't mm-hmm. important, but
it sets an example, I think
it
for
does.
Other cities to do more other than the immediate vicinity to their concert halls, which can be slightly, you know, rich
definitely.
And more wealthy.
Definitely. And I was chatting to the CEO of Nashville Symphony Orchestra recently, and they've got a very similar program called Accelerando, and that's where they're shepherding young talent through schools into conservatories to change that talent pool in sort of years to come. So it's obviously something that lots of other people are thinking about.
And I think there's something as well about a working professional, you know, practicing musicians coming in and working with young students. Because I know there are, you know, there are obviously the music colleges in London with these junior departments, and there are bursaries and all that kind of thing available for people to go to those colleges. But there's something about, I think, yeah, having that connection with an orchestra that's out there that could be invaluable in providing opportunities later on in careers, which is actually one of the hardest things, I think.
Yeah.
So here's, in fact, a bit of Simon Rattle and the LSO performing some Haydn to bring us to the next story.
Thank you.
So did the LSO's performance bring you out in goosebumps, Michael?
Yes, well, it did, actually. this is relating to a news story recently, yet another study, if we need another study about these things, looking at the human reaction to music and whether it, you know, creates a physical response, goosebumps, chills, those sorts of things. And this was done at the University of Southern California. And what they've discovered, based on the 20 people, so not a huge amount of people, is that people who experience chills to music or goosebumps, those kinds of things, actually have a higher volume of fibers between their neurological cortex and the emotional centers of the brain.
But wasn't there an entirely separate study at the Reading Festival that suggested that people who have goosebumps also earn more and are more creative? And actually, whether those two go together, earn more and be creative, I have absolutely no idea.
Also, I was curious about that because I think the demographic of Reading Festival is mostly teenagers, so I don't know necessarily how helpful that is.
I wonder.
For your wage earning.
And it's a different kind of music as well. I don't think at the Reading Festival that you get the English Chamber Orchestra. But
And what I found interesting about this Californian study was the participants selected the music they were listening to. So you're almost pre-formed to sort of know that you're going to react to it, perhaps, because it's maybe something they love or that they are connected to in some emotional way. So it might be more interesting to play the music that they don't know.
And everyone gets goosebumps, whether it be theatre, whether it be looking at a piece of art, whether it be listening to music. I mean, it's not goosebumps are, as you say, a neurological or auditory sort of response.
But do they mean actual goosebumps, like physically being able to see the goosebumps on your body?
I think they're using it loosely, so they call it chills. So it's if you physically react.
Because I think some people do have like a real physical reaction, don't they, where like the hair on their skin kind of stand up, don't they?
True.
But that's quite extreme.
It is.
And less of a metaphorical
thing. I wonder why we feel
the
need to get to the bottom of these things, because it should just have a nice sense of mystery and magic about it, don't you think?
Yeah. Although I quite like the idea of earning 12% more, if I goosebumps, frankly.
Yeah,
I mean,
not?
I'm all for that. Talking of goosebumps, I had a tour round the Royal Opera House's new revamped foyer and Limbury Theatre recently, and that's my new story this month. So the Royal Opera House is aiming to try and sort of open up its space, much like the South Bank has done very successfully, I think, over the past decade or so, which is to bring people in, have a cup of coffee, use it as meeting space, but also see the kind of activity going on around the Opera House. And there's so much going on, you know, rehearsals, people being called for rehearsals. And I think that kind of stuff over the Tannoy will still be heard. You know, can we have Rolando Villas on, please, for Act 2, Scene 3, you know, such and such to make up. I think it's an exciting, it'll be an exciting porthole, I think, onto the daily goings-on at the Opera House. And it looks fantastic. It really does.
The new theatre, yeah.
The new theatre and also the spaces. Yeah. There's a sort of this American walnut, I was told, which is beautiful brown wood, dark brown wood, and lots of travertine stone on the floors. And it's very smart.
Lovely. And lots of venues are doing things like this, aren't they, to draw more people in and to obviously to make sort of more income, which is obviously vital for their sort of survival as well. Selling coffee and cake is as important.
I hope it's slightly more affordable coffee and cake at the Opera House, is my one comment.
Who knows? I was quite surprised that it hasn't been open before.
It's a wonderful space. Yeah.
It is a wonderful space, and it's shut up until late afternoon when the audiences come in, and it is I think it's been a missed opportunity. So I'm very pleased that someone has said, Why aren't we catering for the public that passes? I mean, millions of people pass the door of the Opera House every month.
Exactly. And those people who wander in for a coffee or a cake might then go to buy a ticket at some point. So it's getting new people through the door.
And the Limbury Theatre's looking fantastic. It now looks like a proper mini opera house now, rather than much more of a studio theatre. It's now looking sort of, you know, it's got that traditional horseshoe look with, this beautiful walnut. I mean, it's really gorgeous now. I think it was £50 million they spent. It's a lot of money.
I think that's really exciting because I think you need to have those spaces where you can put on smaller opera or contemporary opera or shorter opera. Because, again, when we're thinking about a thing of pathways for getting with orchestras, but I think the same is with opera and with the creators of opera and performers of opera and visitors to opera, to have alternatives or ways of leading people in to perhaps going to see a...
Definitely.
And if that second space is slightly sort of a bit ramshackle and a bit sort of down at heel, which I think Limbury was by the end of its sort of first life, then I think it suggests that, we'll just put the less good stuff in the Limbury. And now it feels like a chamber opera house.
Excited to go and visit it.
Yes.
So let's kick off this month's magazine with an extract from our cover CD, because the cover CD ties in directly with our main theme this month. So that was Jack Liebeck on the violin with the BBC Concert Orchestra conducted by Barry Wordsworth. And that's one track in our Virtuoso Violin cover CD, which is with this month's issue. It's an issue with Paganini on the cover, so an explanation of the mystery and the virtuosity and the devilishness of Paganini. An article which is fascinating, and as much as Julian Haylock, our writer, really explains the sort of technical sort of know-how really behind Paganini's extraordinary playing and the sort of various social reactions to him. And there's also a second feature in which we talk about the slightly less glamorous places that Paganini came to later in life. Manchester, Edinburgh, Chichester, Lincoln, Shrewsbury, not the kind of places that you'd necessarily see a world-class virtuoso back in the 19th century travel to.
Although Liszt, he did those tours, didn't he, as well, of England? They sort of... They put in the work.
They did. And Ratmaninoff too. He came to Bristol, of course, a couple of times, in fact.
Ratmaninoff did.
Yeah.
I love stories like that because it really makes them seem slightly more human. You know, these sort of deified composers a little bit, and you sort of imagine they're sort of far off and they're sort of not sort of, you know, attainable. But actually coming to this country and doing tours of our little cities, it's kind of amazing.
I know. I think Liszt went up to Cheltenham and played in a venue there that's now... A branch of a bank, I think. You can go in there and think,
brilliant.
Oh, Liszt played here once.
Absolutely brilliant.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, what's extraordinary is that, you know, he still had it in those days. You know, he still had the remarkable technique. I mean, he died not long afterwards, but was still trying to cashing in with these concerts. But going back to the main feature, you know, what's extraordinary is the reception was that he... not only was technically brilliant, but had the sweetest tone. I mean, he was an all-round brilliant musician. I mean, he had it.
That's interesting, because actually the reception of Liszt was quite different. You know, he was seen to maybe be kind of cashing in and being a bit of a superficial celebrity in a way, because he had the technique, but people thought he was, you know, a bit vulgar. And they really divided the critics. I mean, that was probably changing taste in England at the time as well, sort of development of... concert behaviour and all that kind of thing. But it's fascinating that these big virtuosos, the kind of the legendary status they have in our concert culture, really.
I don't think he's the easiest man. I think he was taken to court because he wouldn't pay his agent. So I think he was taken to court and the agent won, thank goodness. But, you know, I don't think the agent was, you know, he only won his fee. He didn't get any compensation. So you can read all about Paganini and listen to a wonderful cover disc in our November issue, which is out now. So here's a clip to bring us on to the next feature. So, Rebecca, tell us about Ethel Smyth.
Yeah, so that was an extract from her Concerto for Violin, Horn and Orchestra. So that was actually from 1926. And we've got a lovely feature on her in the November issue written by Kate Kennedy. And essentially we wanted to mark the centenary of the Representation of the People Act. And what better kind of way to do that than a portrait of the British composer and militant suffragette, Ethel Smyth. And this is just a really colourful and vivid feature about her, sort of looking at her involvement with the fight for women's rights and her own experience as a female composer in a male-dominated world at that time. And it kind of explores... she was an important figure in that movement. She actually wrote The March of the Women, which became the anthem of the Women's Social and Political Union. And she took 2 years off composing to dedicate to fighting for women's rights. And yeah, it's just, as I say, it's just a very colourful piece with lots of lovely historical detail, really sort of telling that story.
I think it's also important to realise that she was a fine composer. I mean, you know, obviously a very dedicated and had a huge amount of determination and spirit to actually get this, to help get this movement through. But her music is, as you can hear, very beautiful.
It is. I mean, I love one of the details that when she was a teenager, she, you know, she wanted to be a composer, but her father wasn't too keen on that. And she wanted to go and study in Germany. And again, he wasn't too keen on that. So she just went on strike. It was an early strike. She just, you know, wouldn't go to church, wouldn't go out, wouldn't come down for meals, just stayed in her room. And she ended up going to Leipzig when she was 19 and studying, and she met Brahms and Clara Schumann.
But how many composers wouldn't have been composers if they'd listened to their parents? I mean, there were countless stories of, oh, you will be a lawyer, or you will be an accountant, or you're going to the family firm. I mean, gosh, you know, I wonder how many composers that were stopped, in fact. How many we didn't have because of the parental pressure.
My favourite story in that piece is the one from Thomas Beecham when he visited her in prison. And she's waving a toothbrush out the window, conducting her march to the women below.
Yeah, the fact that she played the organ in the chapel on Sundays in the prison.
It's great. What a great character.
Yeah, definitely. No, and in terms of composition as well, you know, she was the first woman to have an opera performed at the New York Met. And just for context, it was over a century before another by a woman would be performed there. So in recent years, she became Dame Ethel Smythe. And yeah, she just, her spirit, her real passion and spirit really comes across in this piece.
Michael, we're going to talk about the recording of the month now. Should we have a clip first?
I think absolutely, why not? Okay, that was Le Gibet from Gaspard Nuit by Maurice Ravel. That's on our Recording of the Month disc, which is De la Nuit by Dinesh Varjon. It's been described as unremittingly beautiful by David Nice, who did the review for us. And I agree, it's thrilling, the storytelling involved. It's a mix of Schumann, Ravel and Bartok. And it's all tales and it's all fantasy and it's all sort of darkness. And it's absolutely lovely.
And being ECM, it's beautifully recorded as well.
Yeah, it is a beautiful recording.
I love the atmosphere on the darkness of
it. Yeah, really, really brooding. And that sort of says it all for the whole disc. Obviously, it's beautiful as well, but there are some really wonderful, sort of dark, murky moments.
The programme is really fascinating. I mean, you've got Schumann's Fantasiestücke. You've got, obviously, the Ravel, which we've heard, and you've got Bartok's Im Freien, with all these wonderful sort of noises of the outside and these sort of the crickets and the birds and the, you know, it's beautiful stuff.
Yeah.
Very evocative.
Absolutely. It's proper storytelling through music, which I love.
There's something about the night as well in music that's such a kind of rich seam of inspiration for composers and, as you say, can evoke so many different things. And he's a wonderful pianist, isn't he?
He really is, yeah.
Wonderful. She also has Alice Sarah Ott's Nightfall recording recently.
Yes.
A couple of people seem to be captivated by the night. So that's also got a beautiful performance of Ravel's Gaspard in it. So
absolutely.
So it seems to be the flavour of the month, actually.
Definitely. And actually I asked Dinesh on the phone what the attraction and the appeal of that piece is, and I asked if it's the challenge of it, because it is a challenging piece.
Yeah.
And he says it's not the challenges, of course, that are attractive, but he said the challenges are that the difficulty should not be heard and that it is really like telling a story.
Mm. It is. I did a lot of listening for that for our Building a Library piece on Ravel a while ago. Mm. And, I mean, it's just such a tough piece to play. It really is. But then you have to be able to turn it into a story and to bring out the poetry of each of those movements. Otherwise, it's sort of pointless. So, but tough ask.
But a real treat.
The BBC Music Magazine Podcast.
This edition of the BBC Music Magazine podcast is sponsored by Adagio, the leading streaming service for classical music. Discover Adagio's tailor-made search, expert playlists, and exclusive recordings for yourself. Visit podcast.adagio.com and enjoy 14 days for free.
So this is the part of the podcast where we talk about the recordings that have captivated us over the past couple of weeks. And I have to say, this one has been on constant loop. So mine is the latest recording by pianist Víkingur Ólafsson on Deutsche Grammophon. And it's a beautiful recording of original works and arrangements of music by J.S. Bach. I just love the selection, really. I just think that it's such a sort of slightly original mix. You normally have the sort of the same old on some of these, but the very fact that he's mixed these arrangements with some preludes and fugues and a sort of a set of variations in the middle, which I didn't know, is very welcome. So I've chosen the first movement from the Organ Trio Sonata No. 4, which has been arranged by a chap called August Stradal, and I think it's just absolutely mesmerising. That was Víkingur Ólafsson playing the arrangements of Bach's Organ Trio Sonata No. 4. Absolutely gorgeous. Rebecca, what have you brought to the table?
I have brought a disc of string quartets, Shostakovich's No. 8 in C minor and Schubert's No. 14 in D minor, which is his Death and the Maiden string quartet. And they're played by the Aris Quartet, and it's on Genuine Classics. The Aris Quartet have just become BBC New Generation artists, actually, and they've recorded a few discs before. And I was just listening to this for a review for our brief notes section in this magazine, and I was just really struck by the sort of the commitment and the force and sort of personality of their playing, really. And these two works are kind of both haunted by death, really. Shostakovich is. Well, it was written after he'd been in Dresden, and he was so kind of in 1960, sort of documenting the destruction of the city in the Second World War, and obviously really hit home. And also, it was when he'd been struggling with a lot of suicidal thoughts as well. So it's sort of been seen as a sort of his own requiem or his own sort of suicide note in a way. And then the Schubert, so that's obviously called Death and the Maiden, which based on the poem that you hear in the second movement. And also he was sort of facing his own sort of shadow death, was sort of close with him with his illness and heading towards the end of his life. So cheery. Yes.
What are we going to hear?
Cheery. We're going to hear the Allegro Molto from the Shostakovich, which is the second movement.
Michael, what have you chosen this month?
So I've chosen a new release on Onyx Records. This is a selection of music by Arvo Pärt, performed by Victoria Mulliver. And she's performing with the Estonian National Symphony Orchestra under Paavo Järvi. It's a delightful selection. Some of the obvious players are there, Fratres and Spiegel and Spiegel. But the centrepiece is really the Tabula Rasa, which is just stunning. It's seesaws, it's kaleidoscopic, which, you know, Pärt is quite a lot, but I absolutely love it. So the piece I've chosen is part one of the Tabula Rasa Ludus.
And quite meaningful in as much as it's sort of Estonian music performed by Estonians.
Absolutely, and they recorded it in the presence of the composer, so that's even more special, I think. was Ludus, part one of Tabula Rasa, performed by Victoria Mulliver, and second violinist Florian Donderer with the Estonian National Symphony Orchestra and Paavo Jäffi.
Absolutely stunning. So that brings us to the end of this month's podcast. Join us for the December issues podcast in a few weeks' time. So it's goodbye from me and goodbye from everyone else.
Bye-bye.
The BBC Music Magazine Podcast.